Let's open with prayer. Our Father, we come to you in need of your holiness. You are holy, you are righteous. We are not, except in the way that we are clothed with your righteousness. We hunger and thirst for your righteousness, for your holiness. Please open up your word to us that we may learn what it is to be holy and what is your nature of holiness. We ask you to forgive us our sins. There are many. We're looking to Jesus and him only. We ask you this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay. If you know me very well, you know it's inevitable I'm going to give a quote from C.S. Lewis. One of these comes from some letters he wrote to a woman over in America. And he said, "How little people know who think holiness is dull. When one meets a real thing, and perhaps like you have met it only once, it is irresistible. If even 10% of the world's population had it, would not the whole world be converted and happy before a year's end?" What is holiness? It is something that is always spoken of in Reformed circles, but what is it? It is written in 1 Peter 1:15-16. But as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, since it is written, "You shall be holy as I am holy." But what is holiness? And why does Psalm 29 tell us to worship ascribe to the Lord, the glory to his name, and worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness? Or as King James gives, the beauty of holiness. Hold on there. How can holiness be beautiful and splendid? How can it be attractive? For most people, when holiness is mentioned, they think of something grim, of men dressed in gray, of women with their hair in a bun and all with sour faces, of horror, darkness, and such. This is what is holiness, you know. A picture of John Calvin frowning down on you. But in fact, most think of holiness as ugly. But is it really, because we are so used to ugliness of sin that the true beauty of holiness looks grim? But look at the furnishings of the tabernacle and the temple in the Old Testament, and how God, in the holiest of places, surrounds himself with beauty. Look at the heavenly scenes in Revelation, and the beauty just oozes from the pages. What the glory of this! The problem is not God, not holiness, but us. When we truly see holiness, it exposes our own darkness, our own sin. Look at what happened when Peter first gets a glimpse of what Jesus was. Really was when Jesus told Peter to go cast his net into the sea and bring up a whole shoal of fish. And Luke 5:8 says, "When Simon Peter saw this, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, 'Go away from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord.'" God's holiness in Jesus exposed his own unholiness, his own sin. And again, when John saw the glorified Christ in Revelation 1, he said, "When I saw him, I fell at his feet like a dead man. He laid his right hand on me and said, 'Don't be afraid. I am the first and the last and the living one. I was dead, but look, I am alive forever and ever and hold the keys of death and of Hades.'" One of the most dramatic passages in the Bible, which speaks of an encounter with God's holiness, is one thing that spoke of in that video there. Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 6. It says here, In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a high and lofty throne, and his robe filled the temple. Seraphim were standing above him. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another, Kadosh, 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 Yahweh Tzabaoth. Melo kol haaretz kabodo, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. His glory fills the whole earth. The foundations of the doorway shook at the sound of their voices, and the temple was filled with smoke. And then I said, woe is me, for I am unclean, for I am ruined, because I am a man of unclean lips and live among a people of unclean lips, and because my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Now, at first glance, it seems to say, well, because Isaiah cussed a lot. That's not really what, it goes far deeper than that. From out of the heart, the mouth speaks. Remember, it's a key to the understanding of this is in the first verse, talking about when King Uzziah died. King Uzziah was one of the godly kings of Judah, but he was also very arrogant. He took it on himself to go into the temple and burn incense to God, even though the priest told him not to. And leprosy broke out on his forehead. And to the end of his days, he was a leper to the end of the death, till the day of his death. And what does the Bible speak about in Leviticus about being clean and unclean, especially with the diseases they had? When a person was infected with leprosy, the person would have to stay outside the camp and cover his face and cry out, unclean, unclean. And really, that's the way we are until God touches us and makes us pure, cleanses us from our own spiritual leprosy. But something curious happens. Then one of the seraphim flew to me, and in his hand was a glowing coal that he had taken from the altar with tongs. He touched my mouth with it and said, now that this has touched your lips, your wickedness is removed and your sin is atoned for. In Isaiah's case, God's holiness doesn't destroy him, it transforms him. The pastors who are sitting here, What would you have done if you knew that God's call to you was God said? God told him, "I heard the voice of the Lord saying, well, who should I send? Who will go for us?'" And the Hebrew tense here indicates he had been saying this all along, but only now was Isaiah able to hear. And I said, "Here am I, send me." And here is a call that makes him a failure in the ministry, according to some people. Go, say to these people, keep listening, but do not understand. Keep looking, but do not perceive. Dull the minds of these people, deafen their ears, and blind their eyes. Otherwise, I might see with their eyes and hear with their ears, understand with their minds, turn back and be healed. What if that was the calling God was calling you to minister, not to wake people up, but put them to sleep, a slumber that will only be awakened in hell? Not one convert, not one baptism. Would you still accept the call, or would you say, well, I'm going to go sell shoes instead? But sometimes that is the ministry, not to awaken, but to lock the use the keys to lock the doors of heaven. And it's a terrible, terrible ministry. But sometimes that's part of it. And let's see. There is something about holiness and glory that strikes terror in sinful man. One illustration I can think of when I think of holiness is when I lived in Florida for a short time. I frequented a Mexican restaurant there, and they had a variety of sauces to put on their tacos. They ranged from very mild to one called El Scorcho. It is advertised as pure pain for some, pure pleasure for others. Holiness is like that. As we submit to God's transformation of us, He is making us into ones who can not only stand in God's holiness, but revel in it. It will be pure pleasure for us, and we can't think of it right now. But as Psalm 16 points out, you reveal the path of life to me. In your presence is abundant joy, and your right hand are eternal pleasures. But for others, it is pure pain, as His holiness is intolerant of sin and any kind of impurity. That is a terrible thing to think of, but something that is true. But again, 1 Peter says, as the one who called you is holy, you are to be holy in all your conduct. For it is written, be holy because I am holy. But how can that be? And none of us is holy except by the holiness that God bestowed on us through Christ. It is already and not yet. None of us are holy except by declaration. And could I have some people to read the passage? Someone take 1 Peter 2, 9 and 10, okay? And someone else, Isaiah 61, 10, okay? When you find 1 Peter, go ahead and read those verses. You hear that? That is one aspect of sanctification, that God sets us apart from everything else and makes us people for God's own possession. I know the King James says makes us a peculiar people, but the world thinks of us as peculiar. It kind of reminds me of that book and a movie I've never seen called Miss Peregrine's A Home for Peculiar People. That's pretty much a church. Now Isaiah 61:10 talks about clothing us with God's righteousness. Okay. This is one aspect. Already we are clothed with His righteousness by Christ. Because we are not holy yet, God has promised to make us conform to the image of Christ. Now we are clothed and in God's sight, holy and righteous. That's not going to end that way. God has promised to make us holy and righteous. One thing that is often mistaken for holiness is morality. You know, don't drink and smoke and chew. Don't go with those who do. But one can be moral and miss holiness altogether. And you, sometime you might ask Brad, who is more of an expert on Pilgrim's Progress than I am, how Christian got led astray by worldly wise men tell them, you want to get rid of your burden? Go to the city of morality where you'll find Mr. Legality, and he'll help you take your burden off, mistaking morality for holiness. And, of course, he sees the mountain about to fall on him. And finally, evangelist has to come back to him and say, how soon are you so taken away from the path in which I sent you? And sends him right back on the path to the wicket gate. Sometime you ought to let them know about that passage, man. But C.S. Lewis emphasizes this in his essay, Man or Rabbit. This is one essay where Lewis completely loses his temper. People are asking him, well, can't I be a good moral person without Christ? And he ends it to say, all right, Christianity will do you a great more good than you ever wanted or expected. And the first bit of good it will do you is to hammer into your head, and you won't enjoy that. The fact that what you have hitherto called good, all that about leading a decent life and being kind, isn't quite the magnificent and all-important affair you supposed. It will teach you that in fact, you can't be good not for 24 hours on your own moral efforts. And then it will teach you that even if you were, you still wouldn't have achieved the purpose for which you were created. Mere morality is not the end of life. You are made for something different from that. J.S. Mill and Confucius, Socrates was much nearer the reality, simply didn't know what life was about. The people who keep on asking if they can't lead a decent life without Christ don't know what life is about. If they did, they would know that a decent life is mere machinery compared with the thing that we are really made for. Morality is indispensable, but the divine life, which gives itself to us and calls us to be gods, intends for us something in which morality will be swallowed up. Excuse me. We are to be remade. All the rabbit in us is to disappear, the worried, conscientious, ethical rabbit, as well as the cowardly and sensual rabbit. We shall bleed and squeal as the handfuls of fur come out, and then, surprisingly, we'll find it underneath all a thing which we have never yet imagined, a real man, an ageless God, a son of God, strong, radiant, wise, beautiful, and drenched in joy. By the way, I kind of cringe at what Lewis says there, but I can understand what he's talking about. And what it is his own imperfect way of talking about glorification. He later says in another message that the people we encounter are one day will either be someone that you would be, if you saw them now, you would be tempted to worship, like John almost fell down before the angels. Or else a horror that you would run away from in terror. And we are helping each other to one way or the other. But anyway, when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be done away. The idea of reaching a good life without Christ is based on a double error. First, we cannot do it. And secondly, in setting up a good life as our final goal, we have missed the very point of our existence. Morality is a mountain which we cannot climb by our own efforts. And if we could, we should only perish in the ice and unbreathable air of the summit, lacking those wings with which the rest of the journey has to be accomplished. For it is from there that the real ascent begins. The ropes and axes are done away, and the rest is a matter of flying. Holiness is more than mere morality, as I pointed out from Pilgrim's Progress. Look and turn to 1 John 3, and here he says the process God makes us into something that will reflect his glory perfectly. He says, look at how great a love the Father has given us, that we should be called God's children, and we are. The reason the world does not know us is that it didn't know him. Dear friends, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet been revealed. We know that when he appears, we will be like him, because we will see him as he is. And everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself, just as he is pure. It is that hope within us that causes us to work at sanctification of becoming more like Christ. This shows the end result as well as the way there is the way of sanctification. As Lewis mentioned in his essay, the process of sanctification may be hard and painful, but the end result is amazing beyond anything we can imagine. Lewis says in Mere Christianity, On the one hand, we must never imagine our own unaided efforts can be relied on to carry us through the next 24 hours as decent people. If he does not support us, not one of us is safe from some gross sin. On the other hand, no possible degree of holiness or heroism which has ever been recorded of the greatest saints is beyond what he has determined to produce in every one of us in the end. The job will not be completed in this life, but he has means to get us as far as possible before death. I must borrow a parable from George MacDonald. Imagine yourself as a living house. God comes in to rebuild that house. At first, perhaps you can understand what he is doing. He is getting the drains right and stopping the leaks in the roof and so on. And you know that these jobs needed doing, and so you're not surprised. But presently, he starts knocking a house about in a way that hurts abominably and does not seem to make sense. What on earth is he up to? The explanation is that he is building quite a different house from the one you thought of, throwing out a new wing here, putting an extra floor there, running up towers, making courtyards. You thought you were going to be made in a decent little cottage, but he is building a palace. He intends to come and live in it himself. The command, be ye perfect, is not idealistic gas, nor is it a command to do the impossible. He is going to make us into creatures that can obey that command. He said in the Bible that we were gods, and he was going to make good his word. If we let him, for we can prevent him if we choose, I don't agree with that, he will well make the feeblest and filthiest us into something dazzling, radiant, immortal creature, pulsating all through with such energy and joy and wisdom and love as we cannot now imagine. A bright stainless mirror which will reflect to God perfectly, though of course on a smaller scale, his own boundless power and delight and goodness. The process will be long and in parts very painful, but this is what we are in for, nothing less. He meant what he said. So what is this process? The Westminster Shorter Catechism mentioned in question 35. What is sanctification? Sanctification is a work of God's free grace, whereby we are renewed in the whole man after the image of God. We are enabled more and more to die under sin and live under righteousness. Lewis himself first encountered holiness when he was an atheist. One day at a train station, he picked up a book by George MacDonald called Fantastis. It is quite an odd book. It took me about four or five readings to finally get this book, because there is no plot to it. But it is profound in its effect. Lewis says, I did not yet know, and was long in learning, the name of the new quality, the bright shadow that rested on the travels of Anodus, the main character in Fantastes. I do now. It was holiness. Up till now, each visitation of joy had left the common world momentarily a desert. Even when real clouds or trees had been the material of the vision, they had been so only by reminding me of another world, and I did not like the return to ours. But now I saw the bright shadow coming out of the book into the real world and resting there, transforming all common things and yet itself unchanged. Or miraculously, I saw the common things drawn into the bright shadow. That night my imagination was, in a certain sense, baptized, and the rest of me, not unnaturally, took longer. I had not the faintest notion of what I had let myself into by buying Fantastes. That is the nature of holiness. When it touches you, it transforms you, making everything it touches today, touches holiness, holy. Has anyone ever here been touched by this holiness? How will it affect your worship? There's this one popular Christian song. It is such an earworm. I thought about it this morning and couldn't get it out of my head. It goes on, our God is an awesome God. He reigns in heaven above with wisdom, power, and love. Our God is an awesome God. And this This song then repeats over and over and over and over ad infinitum, ad nauseum. Now, there's nothing wrong with words, but it is a way it is sung, almost in a flippant way. There is nothing awesome about this song. I know what you're about to say. Well, we don't have this problem. We sing the Psalms. Oh, really? Make a joyful noise unto the Lord. Have you ever looked at those Psalms? Have you really worshiped God? It is a rare thing, even in the RP church. How do I know? Look at what happens when the service dismisses and listen to the chatter. Has anyone really been in the presence of God? If you had an audience with Queen Elizabeth or President Trump, would you leave the place chattering about, oh, I wonder who's going to be in the final four? Where is the awe? Lewis points this out in his novel, Perelander, where he travels to Venus and meets the Adam and Eve of that world, and the tempter is there too, and he's trying to keep that world from falling as ours did. And he experienced this awe and holiness when he said, as soon as the lady was out of sight, Ransom's first impulse was to run his hands through his hair, expel the breath from his lungs in a long whistle, to light a cigarette, to put his hands in the pockets, and in general, go through all that ritual of relaxation that a man performs on finding himself alone after a rather trying interview. But he had no cigarettes and no pockets, nor indeed did he feel himself alone. That sense of being in someone's presence, which has descended on him with such unbearable pressure during the very first moments of his conversation with the lady, did not disappear when he had left her. It was, if anything, increased. Her society had been, in some degree, a protection against it, and her absence left him not to solitude, but to a more formidable kind of privacy. At first, it was almost intolerable. As he put it to us in telling the story, there seemed no room. But later on, he had discovered that it was intolerable only at certain moments. Just at those moments, in fact, symbolized by his impulse to smoke and put his hands in his pockets. When a man asserts his independence and feels that now at last he's on his own. When you felt like that, the very air seemed too crowded to breathe. A complete fullness seemed to be excluding you from a place which nevertheless you were unable to leave. But when you gave in to the thing, gave yourself up to it, there was no burden to be borne. Became not a load, but a medium, a sort of splendor as of eatable, drinkable, breathable gold, which fed and carried you and not only poured into you, but out from you as well. Taken the wrong way, it suffocated. Taken the right way, it made terrestrial life seem, by comparison, a vacuum. At first, of course, the wrong moments occurred pretty often. But like a man who has a wound which hurts him in certain positions and who gradually learns to avoid those positions, Ransom learned not to make that inner gesture. Once again, that's the El Scorcho. It's pure pain for some, pure pleasure for others. This is also borne out in a classic children's story called The Wind and the Willows. In the chapter, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn, Rat says, this is the place of my song dream, the place where the music played to me, whispered the rat as if he was in a trance. Here in this holy place, if anywhere, surely we shall find him. Then suddenly the mole felt a great awe fall upon him, an awe that turned his muscles to water, bowed his head, and rooted his feet to the ground. It was no panic terror. Instead, he felt wonderfully at peace and happy. But it was an awe that smote and held him without seeing. He knew it could only mean that some august presence was very near. With difficulty, he turned to look for his friend and saw him at his side, cowed, stricken, and trembling violently. Still, there was that utter silence in the populous... utter silence in the populous bird-haunting Poplars bird haunted branches around them, and the light grew and grew. Perhaps he would never have dared to raise his eyes, but that though the piping was now hushed, the call and summons seemed still dominant and imperious. He might not refuse, were death himself waiting to strike him instantly. And once he had looked with mortal eye, and things rightly kept hidden, trembling he obeyed and raised his humble head. Then in that utter clearness of imminent dawn, where nature, flushed with fullness of incredible color, seemed to hold her breath for the event, he looked into the very eyes of his friend and helper. Skipping on, it says, and all this he saw, for one moment, breathless and intense, vivid on the morning sky, and still as he looked, he lived. And still as he lived, he wondered. Rat, he found breath to whisper, are you afraid? Afraid, murmured the rat, his eyes shining with unutterable love. Afraid of him? Oh, never, never. And yet, oh, mole, I am afraid. And the two animals, crouching to the earth, bowed their heads and did worship. Now, I had reservations quoting The Wind in the Willows. Now, I know this reference here is a reference to the Greek god Pan. Kenneth Graham was an admitted pagan and worshipped this false god as an embodiment of spring. But the point I'm making here is, if Graham, referring to a false god, pictures holiness better than any of us can, how much more when we encounter the true and living God? This talks about the fear of God, and Jerry Bridges wrote an excellent book I'd recommend to you called The Joy of Fearing God. And people think fearing God is joyful? You wouldn't believe it. When you are in God's presence, in the awe, in the reverence, in the holiness, there is something that makes you tremble. And this is not, as he says, a servile fear where you're afraid of someone who beat you up, but a filial fear, as you fear a father. But Lewis, in his Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, mentions that when they children first encountered Aslan, the lion, and says for Aslan himself, the beavers and the children didn't know what to do or say when they saw him. People who have not been in Narnia sometimes think that a thing cannot be good and terrible at the same time. For if the children had ever thought so, they were cured of it now. For then they tried to look at Aslan's face and just caught a glimpse of the golden mane and the great, royal, solemn, overwhelming eyes. And then they found they couldn't look at him at all and went all trembly. That is experience really of worship, being in awe. And Hebrews chapter 12, turn to Hebrews chapter 12, starting with verse 18, it has this picture. For you have not come to what could be touched, to a blazing fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to the blast of a trumpet, the sound of words. Those who heard it begged that not another word be spoken to them, for they could not bear what was commanded. And even an animal touches a mountain, it must be stoned. The appearance was so terrifying that Moses said, I am terrified and trembling. Now you're saying, I'm glad I don't have to face that. But remember, Hebrews, in the entire letter, proceeds from the lesser to the greater, from shadow to substance. The next verses bear this out, beginning in verse 22. Instead, you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to myriads of angels in festive gathering, to the assembly of the firstborn whose names have been written in heaven, to God who is the judge of all, to the spirits of righteous people made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and the sprinkled blood, which says better things than the blood of Abel. Make sure that you do not reject the one who speaks. For if they did not escape when they rejected him who warned them on earth, even less will we, if we turn away from him who warns us from heaven. His voice shook the earth at that time, but now he promised, yet one more I will shake, once more I will shake not only the earth, but also heaven. This expression, yet once more, indicates the removal of what can be shaken, that is, created things, so that what is not shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us hold on to grace. By it we may serve God acceptable with reverence and awe. For our God is consuming fire. Now, if that doesn't make you tremble, nothing will. I challenge you to, in your off time, to read the fourth and fifth chapters of Revelation and see what heavenly worship truly is. It's not just murmuring favorite psalms. It is much more than that. Of course, I'm not disparaging the psalms. You're on the right track when you're singing the psalms, but you remember what the psalms are about. I'd like to share with you a story which I wrote shows the call of holiness and what it does. It's called Quest of the Zealous Bird. It shows the attractive nature of holiness and what happens when it touches you. And I'll tell you how I wrote it. I didn't even think of what it was about when I thought it. I was at the Horn Creek Conference and in the gymnasium there, and I saw on the basketball court Horn Creek Zeller Birds. I thought, what's a Zeller Bird? I thought of this story. Thought it was just a neat story to write, but when I finished it, I thought, this is holiness. What happens when it calls you? What happens when it touches you? I have it right here. I'd like to give a copy to every one of you. Where's the last page? And finish it, this lecture, I'd like us to sing Psalm 29a. My friend Daryl Parnell got the idea of what it is to worship God in his holiness one evening when he sang this psalm. And this time he didn't sing it a cappella. It was accompanied by the sound of a monster EF5 tornado passing just a few blocks from his house. He said his heart was in his throat and he could barely speak out the words. Now, before we sing it, when Brad is too passing out the stories, I'd like him to come up and give an explanation of this psalm.